Hey there. Are you tired of waiting for the next episode of It's Probably Not Aliens? Well, we've got some good news for you. On Nebula, our streaming service, you can get access to all our episodes a week early. That's right. You'll never have to wait again to hear Scott and I debunk the latest ancient astronaut theory or get a movie fact wrong. But that's not all. Nebula is home to dozens of content creators we know you like, so you can find all your favorites in one place. Plus, we post content on there that you won't find anywhere else. And the best part? By signing up for Nebula at nebula.tv/probablynotaliens, you're directly supporting the show and both of us. So don't wait any longer. Join Nebula today and listen to the next episode right after this one.
I've got a cold open.
You got a bell?
What is that? We're talking about this today.
Yeah, the ringing of the bell.
You can't unring that bell, can you?
No. I feel like this is like one of our more, like, we've belayed the groundwork building up to this episode. Like, we have built hype for Die Glocke.
I'm excited about this one. I've been on the edge of my seat.
You've been edging for months.
I've been edging to the bell for months, waiting for this. We're talking about a bell today. This isn't even a cold open. This is just opening the podcast.
This is the hottest of opens.
This is one of our hotter opens that we're talking about because we got to talk about ding, ding, ding. It's bell time.
Yeah. So general thing. Did the Nazis build a time machine? Did they discover free energy? Is it shaped like a bell?
Probably not. Probably not.
The answer might not surprise you because we're not speaking German right now. Well, unless you're in Germany, then you're probably speaking German right now. But we're not speaking German right now.
Did you know that on Apple Podcasts, they just released a feature where you can see a transcription of the podcast?
Oh, no.
And if that is the case, I wonder if they also will do a translation of the podcast. And
so us in German saying, that's why we're not speaking German.
You could theoretically read us in German saying that we're not speaking German, which we're not speaking German, but.
I Don't Speak German is actually a really good podcast too. That's a different one.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so like that's the topic of today. Do we need like a millions around the world?
Yeah. This is so weird to us. We came in with no idea of a cold open. I just had a bell sound effect and that's all we were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But we are recording a podcast.
Yeah.
This is a podcast. It's called It's Probably Not Aliens. Welcome, friends and listeners. This is a show where we look into the TV show Ancient Aliens and other ancient astronaut theories and debunk them while also learning about the real world history of really cool, not even really cool. Yeah, I can't say really cool stuff. We're on a Nazi kick right now. Nazis, not cool. Don't like them.
Yeah, not a fan.
But at least learn the real history behind people and places and cultures and artifacts and all sorts of interesting things. I think it's safe to say interesting.
Yeah.
Right? Sure. My name is Scott Nicewander. I'm one of the two hosts of this show, and I don't know anything except for how excited I am to talk about this thing, because out of all of the Nazi conspiracy, alien conspiracy theories that we've covered over the last couple months, this is the one that I, as a layperson, know about.
Yeah.
And so I'm excited to dive into it.
Yeah, we're about to do the most well-known Nazi UFO conspiracy of them all. My name's Tristan. I'm the one whom does the research and I'm the one for whom the bell tolls is who we'll go for.
That's you.
It's a mental toll, but yeah, it's
I'm sure it is.
Wordplay.
Yes. Should we get into the claim?
Yeah.
Let me hit it.
Millions of people around the world believe that the Germans during the World War II, the Nazis, as they are called, invented something called Die Glocke, which is German for the Glock, the Glock 19. Cool. They invented the handgun. No. Die Glocke stands for the bell, kind of like Glockenspiel.
Oh, that makes sense to me.
And that it was part of the Wunderwaffe, the Wonder Weapon program that we have talked about several times on the show.
So much.
This time period where Germany was desperately trying to invent crazy weapons as like a sort of propaganda effort to convince Germans that, no, the Soviets aren't beating down our doors right now. It's fine.
We've got some stuff in the back. We've got some cool weapons in the back they're not even ready for. And we're not ready for, because they don't exist.
And so they were like weapons designed more for propaganda purpose than actual practical purpose. So they were like giant tanks or rocket planes or things like that.
Big gun.
Big gun.
Make gun, but huge. Make enormous gun that can shoot across continents.
Yeah, stuff like that. And so, but that sort of propaganda program, which led to a bunch of impractical weapons, also spurred a lot of rumors that they had some real weapons that had some like real and dangerous purposes. And the Bell is one of them. The conspiracy theory is that they invented something pretty insane. And also Ancient Aliens, you know, they give it a little bit of flourish by pointing out that, because like, if you want to talk about this in the context of Ancient Aliens, their claim is that two things happened. The Nazis knew about Ancient Aliens, and they sent out archaeologists to go and explore places like India to find remnants of like ancient high technology. But that also they had a UFO in their possession that had crashed in the Black Forest in the 1930s that they had reverse engineered to develop some of their science fiction technology. So like, that's like the main bits about why they claim that the Nazis had all this high tech. And the idea is that this was one of those ones that was made from reverse engineering UFO stuff. And it was this glowing rotating contraption that can produce anti-gravity. And some claim that it was even a time machine.
Yeah, the time machine part of it is what I know best, I think, because I'm sure we'll get into it, but I don't want to spoil it, but I don't think the Bell has ever been found. I could be wrong, but I think there is a structure that remains that people are like, this is where the Bell was, it time traveled and it's not here. So we'll get into it, I'm sure, this is what I know off the top of my very shiny dome.
Yeah, perfect. That's actually a pretty good way to get into it. So the rumor is that the Germans developed this by having a substance called Zerum 525, this highly radioactive substance that when put in this device that had two counter-rotating cylinders filled with a mercury-like substance, that it could produce like either like an anti-gravity effect or radiation, or it could travel in time. So kind of breaking down, because we've covered a few of these things already, the counter-rotating cylinder thing, I believe, is the sort of vortex energy thing that we talked about in our first Nazi episode when we talked about I'm trying to remember what the guy's name was again. It's been a bit now, but
is it Schauberger?
Schauberger, yeah. Schauberger with his vortex-based energy thing.
Yes.
There's just a when they talk about Vimanas and how they worked, they refer to flywheels and mercury being a big part of it.
Gotcha.
So mercury shows up a lot in like these sort of Frank technology things, and that this like secret Zerum 525 is I have no idea where that comes from, but
no idea.
The idea is that it emitted a bunch of radiation when it was first turned on, which led to several scientists' deaths or health problems, resulted in this like 4 meters or like 12 to 15 foot tall device that was shaped like a bell, hence the name
shaped like a bell. Yeah. Was it the wrong button? That one.
Mm-hmm. Now, according to some UFO believers, they think that this device was discovered by the Allies after World War II, where it was then transported to the United States to Area 51 as part of their UFO reverse engineering effort.
So that's interesting, because I always assumed it was missing because it did succeed in travel through time.
Here's the best part, is that when you're dealing with UFO conspiracies, you don't have to be mutually exclusive. It can have been transported back to the US, and it can have disappeared at the same time, because
why not?
Some people believe one, some people believe the other, depending upon whether you want to exonerate the US or not, basically.
Okay.
They believe that it was given to the US in exchange for the freedom of an SS general by the name of Hans Kammler. We'll give you our super weapon that could go back in time and save him before he even got captured. But
I get you.
Yeah. So basically it's big, it's weird. It's got all these really, like, apparently also has like thorium, which is a known radioactive fissile material that it's interesting. Thorium that was one of the ones mentioned because it's, I'm trying to think how to describe it properly, but it is the most common of what are called the rare earth minerals.
Oh, okay.
Because there's this whole thing with thorium that actually is like really, really interesting about how it could be one of the ways that we combat climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Like in a serious way, because I feel like I've already talked about thorium on this web show before, but thorium is a material that is common enough that it can actually be harvested but from seawater, but it is fissile enough that you can, or at least, you know, they highly believe that you could make a nuclear reactor that uses thorium instead of uranium as its fuel, specifically by mixing it with fluoride and turning it into a sort of salt called thorium tetrafluoride, where if you keep it at a hot temperature, the chain reaction in the soup, the liquid, would keep it hot for decades and generate energy. And the whole cool thing about that is because it's liquid, it actually can't melt down. Because the idea is that you'd build a thorium nuclear power plant by filling it with this, like, they're called lifter reactors or liquid fluorides, or lifter, LFTR. So liquid fluoride thorium reactors. And they would have these, like, this hot liquid of thorium tetrafluoride in it that, because of the chain reaction, is constantly emitting heat. And you can just put little bits of thorium into it to keep it going. And if anything does go wrong, what it would be is that at the bottom, it would have like a drainage plug that is held in place by a piece of ice that's constantly being kept cold with, like, you know, liquid helium or something like that, like really, really cold, that is being powered by the nuclear reaction. So if the power goes out, it stops cooling the plug melts, and all of the fluoride goes into a catch container in underground. So literally, like, this thing could get hit with an earthquake and you would not, like, have to deal with like all the issues that nuclear power plants have. The only problem is that not enough science has been done to look into how do we prepare thorium for that kind of power, because unlike uranium, thorium can't be refined into plutonium to then be used in nuclear bombs. So, like, there wasn't much interest.
Oh, we can't make weapons out of it?
Yeah.
Man.
But this has been
as we've talked about several times on this show, it is hard to make progress in a scientific field if you can't convince governments that you can kill people with it.
Yeah. To that point, the most amount of development for this technology has come from a brief period in the 50s when it was being investigated as a way to make a nuclear-powered airplane, specifically like a jet fighter.
Hmm.
But now, like, the thing is that, and I know that it's also a little bit controversial in some engineering circles. Some people think that it's viable, some think it isn't. But the thing is that thorium is like a throwaway material in rare earth mines. And rare earth mines are like the kind of, like, rare earth mines are where we get a lot of this.
Well, they're not common. Yeah. They said it's in the name.
They're common enough. Like, they're rare earth mines are where we get the stuff that we need to make, like, touch screens and, like, computer parts and stuff like that. So we're trying to find as many of them as possible and build up a lot of them. The thing, though, and this is the part that I think makes where, like, a lot of the backlash comes from, is that one of the biggest producers of rare earth minerals on Earth is China. And it's one of the reasons why China is investing a lot in trying to figure out thorium power, because climate change and everything like that. So
either way,
that was a long, long diatribe to just talk about thorium, because I think thorium is interesting. But yeah, it's got a whole bunch of other interesting things associated with it. And it has been associated with topics of, with basically like three major crank conspiracy theories. One we've talked about extensively in the last few weeks. Two, I don't think we've touched quite yet. So one is Nazi occultism. You know, Nazis building a time machine would appeal to them. Two, the anti-gravity people. There is an entire anti-gravity conspiracy theory that we haven't gotten into yet. There's we were talking about trying to do a setup of a payoff later that we haven't gotten into that one yet. And two, three, free energy. So, like, those are like the free sort of crankeries we haven't gotten into yet. Yeah. So this isn't even the debunking part yet, but immediately, when do you think we first heard rumors of the bell? Like, when do you think DeGlocka first entered into the mainstream?
I have to imagine it was nowhere near World War II. Like, it was not actually where I have to imagine it was like decades later, like 80s, 90s.
So the first ever writing about DeGlocka came from a book called Prawda o Wunderwaffe by Polish journalist Igor Witowski.
Okay.
This was published in the year 2000.
Oh, So, like,
not even the same century.
Nope.
It was then later popularized by a military journalist named Nick Cook in a 2001 book called The Hunt for Zero Point. Zero Point cool. being a zero point energy, also being another like kind of crankery free yeah. energy thing.
Hold on. Are you saying Syndrome from The Incredibles didn't actually invent zero point energy? I disagree.
Well, The Incredibles as being a... do you ever see the thing about The Incredibles being like a Ayn Randian allegory for like whatever?
Yes, Brad Bird has weird views sometimes. I think Brad Bird is complicated. I think he's probably a good person, but I think he unintentionally keeps making movies where people are special and are individuals are just special. And yeah, I don't know. It's a whole thing.
Yeah. So that's where it got popularized in the English language was this, the hunt for zero point, again, a free energy thing. And that's when it got like a lot of stuff written about it. People criticize these claims about DiGlocca because they were based on recycled rumors and probably hoaxes. I'm just trying to like do this. Like, this is the story about where it came from.
Yeah.
This guy wrote this book and then another guy wrote a book a year later that came out in English and it immediately got a whole bunch of backlash, but it got adopted very easily by the idea that there was broader conspiracy theories about the Nazis having advanced technology and even the secret space program. So like this kind of stuff all fit into that narrative. Yeah, I keep being told that there was another podcast that talked a lot about the secret space program that I should like talk to and learn more about.
Yeah, there's definitely, ever since we did our episode about the secret space program, we've got a lot of people saying you should talk to this person, you should talk to this podcast, stuff like that. So people are really interested in it as an up and coming conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
well, we'll revisit it for sure. I'm sure of it.
For real. Yeah. The other person who talked about it a little bit is a guy named Joseph Farrell, who's also a big guy like that. So to kind of recap the story, it comes out by this Polish author who makes this, Igor Witowski makes this book. Then mm-hmm. it gets to a wider audience by getting picked up by a Nick Cook, who was a former editor of Defense Weekly and wrote about it in his Zero Point book, which then got even more popular. And then Joseph Farrell, who is a guy who focuses on working about like who writes a lot about Nazi secret technology and stuff like that, added DiGlocca in the context of his broader theories about advanced or esoteric weapons. And it got immediately induced into all sorts of things, making it into even places like Duncan Rhodes, who was the editor of Nexus magazine, which is sort of like this alternative crank magazine that covers like, you know, UFOs, the paranormal, all that kind of stuff.
DiGlocca feels like Nazi DLC.
Yeah.
we're like years later, everyone's like, all right, we think we know the whole story. And then it's like, actually,
what I really like about
we got
it all,
this new one.
Yeah. What I really like is, and I think that this would be a really interesting literary study. If there's anybody who's doing like a master's in literature, I'd be very interested in seeing if someone can make this. Teasing out these more scientific conspiracy theories and their like their lineage from when they showed up in culture and their connection to trends in science fiction.
Mm.
Like in the early, like this feels more modern because it came out in 2000. So
it came out in 2000. Yeah.
So it has more of like a modern idea of how we would think about a sci-fi technology, where if this came out in the 50s, it would be like, it's a flying spoon that shoots lasers out of it or something like that. You know, cause science fiction was a different thing back then.
Tristan, this conspiracy theory is younger than both of us.
That is true.
That is sad to think about, mostly because I don't like thinking about my own mortality.
Yeah, every time a young person is like, you were born in the 20th century, I am just like, I feel like I get more arthritis every time somebody says that to me.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's already so much going of arthritis throughout my body. I don't need more.
I was already getting that when like people like you started becoming like popular, because when I was like, oh yeah, I was born in the 80s, and everyone's like, oh, the 80s, Mr. Old Pants.
Oh my God. So many of my favorite like creators online are like in their mid to late 20s. And I'm like, why are you younger than me? Mm-hmm. Stop. Stop being better and more successful than me, please.
Listen, I had to break that when I found out that Taylor Swift is younger than me.
Mm.
She's like 13 months younger than me. And I'm like, well, shit. Well, I like the thing is she came onto the scene so early that like that kind of got out of my system very quickly. Cause like,
yeah,
if Taylor Swift can be like an international sensation and she's younger than I am, then I guess like also like Rihanna's like the same age as me. So I don't know. It's a whole thing.
It's a whole thing.
But I was still technically born during the Reagan administration. Very technically. I was born the month that that George Bush was elected.
Well, time turns us all into dust, Tristan.
That is true. Speaking of dust, so this got popularized, and then literally less than 10 years after it entered into literature, it got picked up by Ancient Aliens. I love this quote I took from the internet. The television series Ancient Aliens has played a significant role in spreading D-Glockagame, particularly in the episode titled Aliens and the Third Reich. The episode we are doing right now.
We're doing this. This is one episode we keep making our own podcast episodes about for like 2 months straight.
Yeah. We're going to do something different next week, but that's.
Yes. This is the big finale of Ancient Aliens in the Third Reich for now.
Yeah, we have a few more, but I'll get into that next episode.
Yeah.
But the narrative. So, yeah, the idea is that it's been further embellished. And that's when like it started off as a time machine, but then got latched onto other conspiracy theories as they build more things.
OK, so that's interesting to know, because like I said, I always associated it as a time machine. That's always how I've heard of it. So it started out that way. And then they started putting other stuff on it, like, and it does anti-gravity. And it can fly and it can shoot lasers or what have you.
Yeah.
But like the main thing at the time was time travel, right?
Yeah. And I'll explain why. Because like there are multiple, what I guess like the umbrella conspiracies of this are what are called the suppressed technology conspiracy movements. And the two big ones in that space are free energy and anti-gravity. Basically, the idea is that in both of them, I'll get into, but like anti-gravity is this idea that there's this phenomenon in physics that would make levitating objects extremely easy. Like there's this secret hack that basically makes something not be affected by gravity, which would make shipping, but also going to space and all that stuff extremely easy, but that the government is suppressing it in order to keep humans from, you know, exploring the cosmos or whatever, you know, nefarious reason that they think the Jews did it.
Sure.
Usually. Or the they who then ends up being the Jews if you just dig hard enough.
Yeah.
And then, like to the point where like I've heard stories about like, oh, like this Chinese scientist discovered anti-gravity and then she was captured by the Chinese and sent back to China. And it's like, okay.
Sure.
The other is that free energy exists, which is this idea that there's this pollution-free, no-cost energy source that governments and corporations are keeping, or special interests in like three brackets, are keeping under wraps because then they can sell us oil or something instead of, you know, becoming multi-trillionaires by being the people selling the free energy machines.
That's fair.
They would rather have us all die. Instead, that's what they would rather do. They would like to be billionaires selling us oil instead of becoming multi-trillionaires and also being hailed as the saviors of humanity by unleashing free energy.
I feel like this is one of those conspiracy theories that is like so close to like an actual thing. Like, I do believe that energy company, especially like big oil, quote unquote, does a lot of lobbying to like keep all of the energy needs in specifically in the US to be very reliant on them so that they can make money. I don't think that's a conspiracy theory. I think that is just a proven fact.
I think there's like a conflation of a few phenomena here that I think is interesting to actually unpack.
Okay.
Because it's a good one. Because it does come close to like, yeah, there's like, you're getting onto some real stuff and you're also getting like, it's getting mixed in some ways that are important to break through. So one, yes, car companies definitely did have a conspiracy in the early 20th century, specifically to promote individual car use and suppress public transit options. That did happen in the early 20th century. If you want to check out, you can look into the Werner Herzog documentary, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, to get a little bit more details.
Uh-huh.
But like, that is a real phenomenon that like there were auto companies that specifically targeted and killed public transit options because it was competition to their cars. The second is that oil companies did know about climate change as a phenomenon as early as the late 1950s and intentionally sowed doubt and is suppressed science about it to the point where they're now possibly going to be sued for like a fuckload of money for holding back on this for so long. And that like the techniques that they used to do that were directly taken from the people who tried to suppress the link between cancer and smoking and created the political situation of climate change. They basically created climate change denial and got us to the point where we're at now, where they decided to turn, how do we change our energy thing, our energy system, so we don't kill ourselves, into how do we take that? How do we turn that into a political issue? How do we make a left and right side of how do we stop ourselves from killing ourselves?
Yeah. How do we turn, we should probably stop killing the earth, into a, well, there are two sides to this.
Yeah.
Sort of a
And they've
question.
Been very effective, because I can remember like George Bush Sr. was talking about how important climate change was.
George Bush Sr.
Hardly a bastion of liberal lefty stuff, the fucking CIA president. Either way, that is the case. But the idea, but like those two can very easily be meshed together in the head that then these companies together are actively trying to suppress new technologies that would benefit like energy production. When that, and I'll have to be careful in my wording here, but if that is the case, I don't necessarily think so. And the reason that I don't think so is because there are many reasons why renewable energy sources did not take off the way they do that are understandable through economics. Specifically, like solar and wind energy did not take off until the governments put significant effort into putting money into developing that technology. Because basically the whole thing that held us up was that oil is a easy to obtain and very energy dense while being light source of energy. And that made it way easier to rely on that and deepen our reliance on it rather than transition to something that is going to be less efficient, going to require like more infrastructure and also a lot of transition cost. And that I think always has led people to, especially people who might have to pay that money, being less incentivized to really embrace that transition until governments realized they need to take climate change seriously. And then they started putting money into developing it. Furthermore, like other things like the electric car, people would say like, oh, like people were developing electric cars like 100 years ago. And that got suppressed. And it's like, well, the thing is that electric cars have a very specific, like the technology behind them isn't that sophisticated. The thing that is always holding them back is the thing that's holding them back now, which is that we can't make batteries powerful that hold enough energy and are light enough to manage things. Batteries like today, to make an electric car is so expensive because it requires tons and tons of these lithium batteries that require difficult to get materials. And then when we put them in, they're very heavy. That's like the main thing holding them back. There's some other technologies that are also getting developed that are very good, like fuel cells, which use like hydrogen. You use a sort of chemical reaction and electricity to split water into hydrogen and oxygen, and then you put it through fuel cells, and in the oxygen and hydrogen turning back into water, it unleashes some energy that then you can use to power things, which would be great because that would mean that we could fill our cars with hydrogen, which is a highly explosive gas, but I mean, so is gasoline, so I guess that's not that big an issue.
Why don't vehicles operate like humans do? I get energy from eating lunch. Why don't I just give my car a sandwich? And then my car can go.
There's a guy who made a robot that actually gets power from food. And everyone was like, it's the robot that eats human flesh.
All right. So we're going to have to work in ethics on these cars that can eat food. Yeah. But.
And there was a time when we were trying to stretch out gasoline by adding ethanol that was derived from corn. And then that led to a fuel price crisis because corn started getting really expensive because we started using it to make
gas.
That's
true. I'm imagining self-driving cars are already being like, all right, we have to figure out how to make sure we don't hit pedestrians. But then when you give that self-driving car the ability to fuel itself off of
human flesh,
then it starts having a crisis of like, I'm low on energy. I shouldn't hit the civilian, but I need to keep going.
Tesla hungry.
What's the ethical thing?
Yeah, this I call him hungry. Me hungry. I'm hungry.
Me hungry. Me, my Tesla, me hungry.
But yeah, anyway. So like that is like the general like reason why I think a lot of people get that kind of stuck in their head. Like there's some real technological choke points that we have to get through with lots of government investment. And because of gasoline made it so like we were incentivized to develop these energy sources for so long, it was reinterpreted as suppression because these are companies that are known for doing heinous evil shit like suppressing the facts about climate change in order to. So it's understandable
also,
why that happened.
Also, just to put a bow on this, the real reason why energy companies don't actually invest in free energy, because you were like, oh, if they could actually invent free energy, they'd become trillionaires and save the human race. How would they become trillionaires, Tristan? It's called free energy. They can't make money off of it. It's free. It's free, Tristan.
Free, just another term for socialist. I think that's actually a line from Watchmen, isn't it?
Socialist energy.
Socialist
free energy.
But the other, but then you're like, if you want to go one step past that and you get into crankery, which is that they are suppressing free energy through what are called perpetual motion machines, which are hypothetical devices that can operate forever without any external power source, and they can be used. The problem is that it violates a fundamental law of physics, specifically the first and second laws of thermodynamics.
Okay, all right.
Which is like,
those sound important.
Free energy doesn't make a lot of sense when the first and second things that we know about the universe is that energy cannot be created or destroyed.
Okay.
And that systems are always moving towards more and more chaos, i.e. there's like no such thing as a 100% efficient system. So basically, like if the first one, like the first one's true, energy can't be created or destroyed. So the most that a perpetual motion machine could be is a 100% efficient engine, which means that all the energy that goes into it stays into it and never leaves. Except for the second law of thermodynamics, which establishes entropy, which is that there is no such thing as a 100% efficient system, and that there's always more chaos and energy, less energy coming out than going in.
See, I faced this same problem when I made my Tesla that's fueled off of sandwiches.
Yep.
And I gave it the ability to make sandwiches in itself. It has a new feature that does that, but it where would it get the ingredients from?
Yeah.
I don't know. I faced that problem pretty quick.
And you know, the lineup at the self-checkout is already so long, let alone having a bunch of cars in the grocery store.
Have a bunch of cars.
Trying to pick up some dumpsters.
Piling up a bunch of loaves of bread in their frunk. Teslas have frunks, right?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Yeah, they do. But yeah, so like people have been trying to make perpetual motion machines as far back as the Middle Ages. And very often they're like, they're scams, or they are just like a fundamental misunderstanding of things. Like sometimes they use like magnet off balance wheels, not realizing that magnets don't actually produce energy. It's like magnets will eventually run out of energy themselves and they don't work anymore.
Yeah, we've talked about this before. There's like a quote, I don't remember if it's like a famous quote from someone, but I just hear it a lot in terms of perpetual motion machines, which is the hardest part of building a perpetual motion machine is finding where to hide the battery.
Perfect. That is the...
Which is
basically
what, anytime you see someone claim they've created a perpetual motion machine, it's they put a battery in there or a magnet.
And it's
or something
fairly
like
often not just cranks, but people who are trying to scam people.
Now, look, there are some like people who make like sculptures or desk toys that are like aimed to look like they're perpetual motion machines, but they're very clearly have like their battery operator or what have you. And those are fine because they're fun to look at. They're very, very satisfying to look at. But anyone who's actually claiming to have created an unlimited source of energy is that no. Yeah. They didn't.
And fairly often, some of those desk toys are just powered by like heat, like from the ambient air.
Sure.
Which is an interesting thing. The other one that is like also like a kind of like thing that fits into this conspiracy of free energy is the idea of cold fusion. So the idea is that cold fusion was this idea that you could create nuclear fusion, but at like room temperature. So if you don't know about how to make fusion, you basically need to heat up hydrogen until it gets as hot as like the center of the sun.
Okay.
Which the sun does through gravity, but we have to do through like these extremely complicated magnetic bottles. And you have to you have to heat it up so much and compress it so much that it turns into helium. And in doing so, it offshoots some of its energy and turns into, you know, it turns into power.
This is what Doc Ock was on about in Spider-Man 2.
The power of the sun, as
in
every article of fusion would say. But cold fusion was this like theoretical idea that you could fuse atoms without using like tons of heat and creating plasma. And the thing is, it got really, really popular in the late 80s when some chemists announced that they had figured out how to do it. But it then never panned out because it was not able to be replicated and it was done through like bad methodology and such. But because it was really, really popular and then it went away when people found out it wasn't actually a thing, people thought that that was another case of them suppressing free energy thing to do.
Everyone's on about it one day and then suddenly everyone is like, we're not doing this anymore. We're not pursuing it. Yeah. And it's because it's hard to do, if not impossible. Mm-hmm. But everyone is like, yeah. I feel like someone's trying to sweep this under the rug.
And it does seem that one Taylor Swift lifespan later, we are getting into, there is some, there's some new, very niche interests in getting into cold fusion again. The thing is that hot fusion is having some major breakthroughs that might turn it into an energy source in like the next like 20, 30 years.
It's hot. Hot fusion's hot again.
They've had a couple cases of actual, like the golden thing, which was ignition, where they were able to have more energy come out of it than they put into it, which was fascinating because like a thing that they did not, they were not able to do before. So they're finally, it seems like the next 10 years, which is funny because everyone says it's about fusion, but like the next few years, maybe the next 5 years about fusion look like they're going to be pretty exciting because it was kind of stagnant for a long time.
All right.
But there is apparently some research into low energy nuclear reactions, but it's a very small amount of researchers and it's still fairly controversial. And it's not widely accepted that they've been able to make it work, but it's a thing that some people are investigating now. But yeah, like, so like, that's like the kind of things that de Glocke like gets tossed onto, that the Nazis invented free energy back in the 40s and they're suppressing
it. They invented free energy. They invented time travel. This is the sort of stuff that it gets latched onto. And what's really interesting to me is, I was going to say, we haven't really described it. I mean, it's just a bell shape. We don't have it physically, but I'm still really interested to learn more about it.
Yeah.
And especially if we get into that little structure that still exists. I wonder if you have stuff to talk about there.
Oh, but
you
do? First, I need to talk about the good word of product and service.
Okay, I'll allow it. Product and service.
Yeah.
One of our favorite things.
It's amazing. So let's get into the big thing, which is that all the principles that de Glocke is said to do, like anti-gravity, time travel,
yep.
None of it is a thing that is real.
What?
Anti-gravity is a thing from science fiction. And at the current moment, we have no actual science that backs up that you can actually negate the effects of gravity.
Now, hold on. Let me ask you this about anti-gravity, because I've always associated it as like the opposite of gravity, right? Anti-gravity. But if we approach it like it's an anti-hero, we're like, the opposite of a hero is a villain. But if it's an anti-hero, maybe this is just like bad gravity.
Evil
maybe
gravity.
This is just like unethical gravity.
Oh my God.
Have we ever considered that angle of anti-gravity? Gravity that's like, it has questionable morals, but at the end of the day, it's still trying to do what gravity does.
I think that's the movie with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney.
Clooney and said, yeah, we need a sequel to Gravity, which is anti-gravity. It's just the same movie, but this time, gravity's a bad boy.
Yeah, this time, all of the space things are clumping together, and that's what causes the crisis. I liked Gravity. It was great. But yeah, the idea is that there's two kinds of forms of anti-gravity that people believe in. One is that if you use superconductors, you know, you could use superconductors to make anti-gravity to negate gravity. And superconductors can create like a way to energy efficiently hover things. It's not a anti-gravity. Like it still is things affected by gravity, but it's an interesting process and it can help with making things very efficient. For example, Tokyo's maglev trains use superconductors to hover the trains magnetically off of the thing.
Make them go real fast.
The only problem is that superconductors need to be kept astonishingly cold. Like you need to use liquid nitrogen to keep it cold enough to be able to do it. If you remember last year, it was a bit of a hullabaloo about a room temperature superconductor. And that was because people were excited about the potential that could happen. And that's a thing that a bunch of material scientists are trying to come in on, but we're not quite there yet.
Not quite there.
The other is that there's this theory that there was something called the graviton, which was like a particle that created gravity, but is also like not a thing, or at least as far as we know, because at the moment, gravity is one of those things that we don't 100% understand how it works in physics. And so the graviton is one of the theorized ways that gravity could function, is that there's just like little particles of gravity that do the thing, but it doesn't seem to really work either. And instead, if you think of gravity less as like a substance and more as like a sort of way that space and time are warped by massive objects, then it's kind of hard to think of an anti version of that.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. And there's some other, like, there's some other idea that there's this theory for a while that antimatter reacts to gravity the opposite of regular matter, which means that it like moves away from objects of mass instead of towards it. But that has also been proven to be wrong, because antimatter is not some sort of like magical negaverse matter. It's just matter that is charged the opposite way that it's supposed to be. Angela Collier made a really great series of videos, I think like two videos on antimatter that are really good. You can get to get into this. She specifically addresses this claim. So
now I same question about antimatter as I had with anti-gravity. Maybe antimatter is just the bad boy.
It's just
matter.
The bad boy matter. Yeah. Positrons are just bad boys.
Oh, yeah.
Data has a completely different outlook from that point.
See, the POS in positron stands for piece. It stands for piece of shit.
Ah.
That's what. But they own it. They're like, yeah, you know what? But I know what I'm about.
That's why whenever you go in for a CAT scan, you're getting just blasted with pieces of shit.
That's right.
Or a PET scan or CAT scan. I think they're the same thing. I don't remember.
Ah,
someone's going to bring it up anyway. The other thing, too, is that anti-gravity is full of, like, you know, bad science and bad reportings of things.
What?
Time travel, too, also is just a thing from science fiction that doesn't have a thing in reality. We did two whole episodes on the concept of time travel, so I don't want to get too much into that. But
with Isaac Arthur, right?
Yeah. But basically, the general gist of it is time travel is 100% possible if you can do one impossible thing.
Yeah. It's one of those, and this was sort of my takeaway from those episodes with Isaac Arthur, was that, like, on paper, like, the math can sometimes work out, but you need
these, like, impossible
to translate
things.
That. Yeah. You need impossible things that don't translate off of the page.
Yeah, you need like matter with negative mass and stuff like that.
Right. You can get the numbers to work, but you can't get it to work in reality because we don't have the things that make the numbers work.
Exactly. Now, in quantum mechanics, apparently there's some stuff where time works in some funky ways with superposition and entanglement. But again, it's first of all, that mostly stems from us having a poor understanding of how quantum mechanics works. And two, if it is time travel, it's like, you know, tiny
sure.
particles being like 1/1,000,000th of a second slightly off or something like that.
All right. So this is a lot of science stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What about the this is a historical thing. I want to learn more about the history of this thing.
Sure. Okay. So the again, outside of the fact that the first claim of de Glacke came in the year 2000 is the piece of physical evidence that's cited to be the source of de Glacke that people use is a concrete structure that's called the henge.
The henge. We love a henge around here.
Yeah. It's located in the Wenceslaus mine, which was, I think, is somewhere in Bohemia. Apparently people say that it is the place where de Glacke was made, and it was like this Nazi experiment site. It's a concrete structure that is that's located near a mine. It was built in around 1943 or 1944, and according to Igor Witkowski, the henge might be the place where it was built and tested. But
yes,
people will point out that the henge looks more like a industrial cooling tower rather than a secret site of science.
So let me paint a word picture for people, because this is the structure I was talking about this is like when people want to point to like physical evidence that the bell existed, this is the structure they point to. When we say a henge, don't instinctively think of Stonehenge, because this is much more industrial looking. Like, it is very, it's more, much more modern. It's much more precise. It's got, you know, pillars, and it's all connected in like a big circle around the top. It almost looks like a big, I don't even know how many sides there are, but if it's like an octagon or a little bit more, it just looks like a very industrial thing, but there's nothing. It's just the henge.
Yeah.
There's nothing else there. It's in like, it looks like it's in a field with some hills behind it. There doesn't seem to be any other structure. It's just like these pillars with like this sort of connecting beams in between them to make like a circle.
Yeah.
But there's nothing else. It doesn't look like anything else is there.
Yeah, it's made of...
And so it sort of stands out.
It's made of concrete. And it is quite, like, you know, interesting. Like, it's visually provocative. And people... It's very easy to think, to look at that. And if you didn't anticipate what it could be by, like, you know, knowing how things look in construction, you would think that this looks like some sort of ominous, cool science fiction-y thing that could be a thing. But it's much more likely from everyone who's looked at it that it was probably either the ruins or the beginnings of construction of a cooling tower that never got built.
I think that's really interesting because, I don't know, it's interesting to think about because when you look at it, it does look like there was something to it. Like, this is like part of a structure and it's the only part that either remains or, but I never considered that it was possibly the part that was the only part that was ever built. And then they just sort of moved on. Interesting idea.
The fact that in 1943, 1944, when the Nazis were starting to suffer some real material issues and stuff, is pretty much things being abandoned does not sound like a surprise to
right.
me. The other thing too is that the Deglocka, the claims made by Witkowski are based on like anecdotes and speculation, and there's nothing they don't have any documents, they don't have any physical evidence, they don't have any eyewitness accounts. It's all basically just cribbing off of secondary sources. So he's literally writing about people who are writing about things that they saw, and it's like, okay,
gotcha.
But writing about people who claim that they saw it. So like it's like third hand accounts and stuff like that.
And again, from like 60 years later or something like that.
Yeah. He did have a background as an investigative journalist, but the fact that he used so many unverified sources puts a lot of question marks into his work. Again, Nick Cook, the person who popularized it, also has been criticized for not really critically discussing the subject or really doing his due diligence to find out if this was actually a real thing. And it looked like he was, the quote that I found here was ferreting out minor inconsistencies and odd ambiguous details, which he tries to puff up into proof. The other person who got really into it, who popularized it, Joseph Farrell, is known for who is into Nazi technology stuff, who wrote SS Brotherhood of the Bell, which connected it to NASA's Nazis, JFK, and Magic 12, which Majestic 12, I think, is going to be its own episode that I want to do at some point.
I have to ask, and maybe you don't have the information, the connection to JFK is just like the moon landing, right? It's not, he wasn't saying, and also the assassination of JFK was also tied to the bell.
I haven't read this book, but I would guess it's both.
Oh, great.
Conspiracy theorists assume that JFK has been assassinated for so many things that he had secret knowledge about the free energy that then got killed by the oil companies or something like that is definitely something I could see being the narrative.
Fair enough.
But very often, everybody who talks about the JFK conspiracy is always just like, he was just about to end the war in Vietnam, bring about world peace, end the Cold War, or, you know, unlock free energy, and then he got shot by whoever's against that, is a very common trope in the sort of JFK conspiracy circle. Why do they do this? Well, Deglocka is really buzzy. It got a lot of attention. So people who like attention and money from selling books will talk about it. It's also just like a community. Alternative history and conspiracy theories have their own sort of community that you can monetize, but also that you can be invested in and become a celebrity within. And being a micro celebrity is another like motivating factor. It can bring traffic to your websites and give you authority, and it can give you a sort of appeal of being a bad boy, like people who are looking for contrarian theories. Like, as we've seen in modern day, I don't think it's too hard to talk about how there are a lot of people who will accept a bad idea if they're just convinced that it is somehow contrary to the mainstream idea, no matter what the actual merits of it are.
And that's why they also are all about that bad boy of gravity.
Exactly.
Anti-gravity.
So here's the thing, though. The Germans, what this is kind of overlapping is that the Germans did actually make a whole lot of very interesting technological breakthroughs during the war. The V-1 and V-2 rockets, the jet aircraft, they made the first jet aircraft, the Messerschmitt ME-262. They did a huge amount of improvement of submarines. And, they did have like the first induced nuclear fission was in 1939, Otto Hahn, and like the first precision guided anti-ship glide bomb was made under the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
So like there is like a lot of like genuine scientific air engineering and warfare breakthrough that happened from Nazi scientists that they can be like kind of building off of.
Sure.
But again, a lot of their most advanced weapons were just prototypes that never actually impacted the war. The nuclear program never went anywhere, as we already talked about. Mm-hmm. The V1 and V2 relied on slave labor and relied on the deaths of a lot of slave labor to build. And the Germans were always, during the war, behind when it came to resources, because the Allies had their colonial empires that they could tap for resources. Like, the Germans did a lot of technological innovation trying to get around the fact that they didn't have access to things like rubber. Like, the Germans invented synthetic rubber during the war because they didn't have colonies with rubber trees that they could tap for rubber for tires for cars. One of their main motivations for needing to defeat the Soviet Union so hard in the early war is because oil. They needed oil. And, you know, planes and trucks and tanks all need oil.
They do need that.
Yeah.
You ever see Jojo Rabbit?
No.
There's a very good joke in it that I feel like ties into this sort of sentiment, where the kids, the child Nazis, have like uniforms that are absolutely falling apart, and they're like, is your uniform made out of paper? And they're like, well, it's paper like. Yeah. It just sort of like shows that in the end times of years of the war, just they did not have the materials needed.
Yeah, that's kind of there's even like, you could even argue that that's why Japan attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor, is because America, which was a major oil exporter at the time, stopped trading oil with Japan, and Japan was running out of oil. One of the other things about the sort of Hiroshima and Nagasaki thing is that, like, the Japanese were not very far away from just having no oil. And if you think about it, like, the war is basically over at that point if you don't have trucks and planes and bombs. And the thing is that, like, it also comes from the fact, like, this, the inspiration behind this whole Nazi science thing comes from the fact that the Nazis had a very weird approach to science. As we talked about, their ideology allowed them to do things that were normal scientists wouldn't have done, because they were crimes against humanity, like the horrors of medical experimentation. But also, at the same time, they also were, their anti-Semitism made them against a whole lot of ideas of how science worked, and they approached more holistic ideologies. And so they were trying to prioritize research areas that benefited Nazi ideology and disparaged Jewish scientists, which led to them getting invested in weird science that never went anywhere. But then people later on would try to reinterpret that as like science that was then suppressed.
Their ideas were too good.
Yeah, exactly. And so that kind of thing is like the main reason why that's a big issue. The main problem, and you can cue up your sound on this one, I think, because I think that
is this the time?
Yeah, it's the time.
Here we go. What was the main problem?
Well, again, Diglocka, like a lot of these conspiracy theories, distorts our understanding of the past, erodes our trust in academic and scientific institutions, because it de-educates the public. What this can do is, one, build a narrative that the Nazis were onto something, that they had all of this secret knowledge and power that was then suppressed. That feeds into white supremacist and neo-Nazi narratives about how the world works.
Right. Because again, you're barely a step away from being like, suppressed by who? And then the answer in these conspiracy theories is always Jewish people.
Yeah, exactly. Also promoting these claims contributes to one of the main people who spread these conspiracy theories was Ernst Sundel, a Holocaust denier. And it definitely is a lot of like this sort of like glamorization of the Nazis for their scientific achievements that aren't real. It overlaps heavily with people who either deny or minimize the Holocaust,
like children's book authors of magical wizard schools, for example.
God, that was such a hog shit take from J.K. Rowling. Oh my God. Not that she's known for having great takes these days, but Jesus Christ.
No.
It's bad even for her. And so to counter this, we should probably, do more Holocaust education. I feel like it's one of those things that we don't talk about enough in history class, because it's kind of difficult and traumatizing to children, but kind of in a necessary way. And also talk about the social, psychological, and political factors that lead to conspiracy beliefs, like the fact that people don't trust institutions because institutions have not done a lot of work to be very trustworthy.
Yeah.
When I like look back on like QAnon, for example, and how many QAnon believers became QAnon believers because like some major part of the government just like failed to serve them in some way. Like one guy who got really into QAnon got into it because the state stopped paying for his like they denied his claim for Medicaid when he was like going through cancer treatments.
Yeah.
And like that kind of stuff is like the kind of stuff that brings people, takes people off the edge.
Yeah. We've talked about this in a previous episode where we'd want to be clear that, you know, when we say stuff like this, like we're not saying you should trust, we're not saying you should trust, you know, like governments more or things like that, but more so that governments need and institutions and stuff like that need to be better about actually earning people's trust.
Yes. And I do think that a lot of like conspiracy theory culture is a side effect of states that have made themselves profoundly untrustworthy institutions.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that. And I think that also a lot of this, like, you know, especially going back to like Nazi technology, is very important. I mean, this predates it because this is an old episode of Ancient Aliens, but is important to address in this period where we're seeing a increase in like right-wing extremism and right-wing populism that is often using conspiracy theories to lure people into further and further right-wing politics. I think that that is like part of what these kinds of conspiracy theories do. I think that's why, like, when you see there's like a huge overlap between the far right and UFO conspiracies and such, because like, if you think about it, esotericism, right? Mm-hmm. Like the lure of esotericism is to that you have knowledge that most of the world doesn't, that you understand the world as it truly is in a way that most of the world doesn't, which is another way of saying that you're further and further being isolated in your concept of how reality works from other people, which makes it much easier for you to then be led into more and more revelations that take you to extremism. And a lot, this is why, like, if you ever talk to neo-Nazis, I don't recommend, by the way, but neo-Nazis are like, their entire worldview is just riddled with conspiracy theories because they have just, they like, Nazism is basically just conspiracy theories, just like just way too many of them crashed together.
Yes.
And it also, like, this kind of stuff, it undoes our concept of knowledge, because like the idea of like scientists and scientific institution and the scientific method and academia and like all that kind of stuff becomes the enemy in this narrative, because they're the ones suppressing the true knowledge, which then,
sure,
you know, like undermines belief in like science and the sort of things we develop, which, you know, is one thing to just say theoretically, but when it comes to a situation where, say, like just for the off chance, say a new virus shows up that causes people to die, and then scientists use some like just on the cusp of breakthrough technology with huge amounts of investment to get things through, they develop a novel vaccine that would have in the past taken many, many years, but because they were just on the cusp of these new developing technologies, they managed to, with absolutely, you know, mind-bending amounts of resources and power, were able to make something. And then you have to get everybody to take it and say, if faith in scientific institutions has been severely undermined through years of neglect and conspiracies, you then end up with that turning into the onus for, in Canada, it almost led to a coup.
Yeah.
There was an attempted coup of the Canadian government over COVID restrictions and vaccine mandates. And, you know, there was more than a handful of COVID denial and COVID, like anti-science, anti-vaccine stuff in the January 6th attempted coup of the American government.
Yeah, also true.
So all that stuff kind of blends together. And this is why, like, not only is like distrust in the government leading to like conspiracies that then lead to bad politics and things like horrible things, but also our erosion of trust in scientific institutions has led to, when we need trust in science, some very dangerous situations. Like the fact that there's now there's over a million people now who aren't here because we decided not to take scientists seriously.
Yeah.
I think like that's enough that like 1 in 300 something Americans are dead because of COVID.
Yeah.
I think almost everybody probably knows at least one person who isn't here because of that virus. And that's the real cost that conspiracy theories can have in society. So that is the end of, that's how the bell is bad.
That's how that, and it all goes back to a bell.
Yeah, That one went some places.
Well, if you would like to go some places, a great place is Probs Not Aliens, at Probs Not Aliens on Twitter and Blue Sky.
Yeah.
How about that?
Good stuff.
That's where you can follow us for all sorts of fun updates and hot takes and things like that. Tristan, what do you do other than this podcast on the internet?
I run a YouTube channel called Step Back, where I talk about the past and or talk about things going on today and then why you need to have like a sort of three-dimensional understanding of the past in order to approach it with wisdom and grace. My latest video is sort of my last video as a full-time YouTuber. I'll still be making stuff, but I'm just, it has to move back to side hustle status. But my next video, or that should be out by the time this episode drops, is going to be about the four books that I read that shape, that basically, if you read these four books, you will understand human nature. That's the gist
the
of
top,
that right now.
All four books are Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Oh, God.
All four, but you read that book four times, you'll understand everything.
I love that Guns, Germs, and Steel has now been like very thoroughly scientifically debunked.
It's
a really great new Rebecca Watson video about it. That's pretty great.
Yeah, it's basically just a meme now.
Yeah. Scott, if I wanted to learn who was the real father of Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch, where would I go for that?
Ooh, a complicated topic. More complicated than you'd think. You can go to my YouTube channel, NerdSync, NERDSYNC. That's an old video. I definitely had hair in that video. That's also one, speaking of like trust in institutions, if I consider myself an institution, which I don't, that was a video where I uploaded it, got some information wrong and had it pointed out in the comments, took it down and refilmed it, put it back up a day later because I'm trustworthy, right? And I learn. I have that integrity, okay? So people trust me. But either way, I'm working on a silly video where I beat a Scooby-Doo video game and I speed run it. It's fun times. Yeah, NerdSync, NERDSYNC. You can also follow this podcast on Nebula, nebula.tv/probablynotaliens. Mm-hmm. That's where you get episodes early, and it also helps support the show. And you also get like a bunch of other cool Nebula stuff. You get all the different videos and podcasts and all sorts of cool content and series and classes and things like that. If you go over there, you can also leave reviews of this podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave feedback on Spotify. I keep getting emails about Spotify feedback. Makes me very happy. Thank you for doing that. And you can tell your friends about the show. You know what? I always say that you can tell your friends about the show. You must tell your friends about the show.
It's true.
You must do it.
It's imperative.
They're not actually your friends if you don't tell them about this show.
Friends don't let friends not hear about this podcast.
It's true. It's true. And a really great place to send them is probsnotaliens.com.
Yeah.
That's a simple website, but it's got links to everywhere where you can listen to this show. So go do that. Until next time, my name is Scott Nicewander.
I'm Tristan Johnson, and the truth is out there. Bing!
I knew you were going to do it.
That would make my son so happy.
He likes bell sounds?
He just likes sounds, like random sounds like that.
Yeah, that sounds like a child.
He laughs when you just like blow in his face. He's at that face.